3, 2, 1.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The corporate whale, ANCSA, the first 10 years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
Of the 13 regional Native corporations whose task it is to manage the money and land granted under the terms of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, all but the Seattle-based 13th Regional Corporation have land entitlements. Six of those 12, Otna, Chugach, Cook Inlet, Nana, Doyon, and Arctic Slope, share 16 million of the 44 million acre total under a complex provision of the Act called the Land Loss Formula. These regional land allocations are based on the size of the land area initially claimed rather than the size of the native population living in the claimed area. The provision was included in ANCSA largely at the urging of the Arctic Slope, whose oil-rich lands were a major impetus in getting Congress to move on a settlement, since oil companies needed to move the North Slope oil to market. The Arctic Slope claimed a large area but had a small population. Under the land loss formula, entitlements range from about 336,000 acres for Chugach Corporation to 8.5 million acres for Doyon Limited. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation's share is a little over 4 million acres. Ownership is of both the surface and subsurface estate, a matter of no small consequence given the developable resources on or under many of those lands. And the Act further states in one of its most controversial provisions, 7I, that 70% of all revenues derived from resource development must be shared among all 12 in-state ANCSA corporations. That one paragraph has caused all 12 to go to court against each other, a case that's been pending for most of the years since ANCSA was signed into law by then-President Richard Nixon on December 18, 1971. Both the land loss formula and 7I, the revenue sharing provision, were intended to be equalizers in the settlement, providing resource revenues to regions without rich lands and additional land to those without large populations. This program, the seventh in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, will examine two regional corporations particularly affected by these provisions, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation in the north and Doyon Limited in the interior.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing the mock talk between family and friend. We're sailing towards the future, we're anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way.
Those messages once again, Judy Sigvan of Wainwright called 4831 this afternoon. To the Wainwright people, anyone picking up two boxes by accident at the airport, please return to Mabel Bodfish's residence or to the school. To Robert Spurgeon in Nuiqsut, you have a green shoulder bag coming in on the flight from Barrow today.
Yeah. Barrow is Alaska's northernmost community. This land of contrasts, of light and darkness, sea mammal hunting and oil development, is the regional center for North Slope Eskimos, seat of the North Slope Borough and headquarters for the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, ASRC. In 1979, AISRC's net worth was $14 million. In 1980, that increased to 24 and a third million. That's without the value of the land entitlement, 4,615,000 acres.
It's a pretty large area. It's anything just about above the Brooks Range. So we're talking about probably 84,000 square miles, which is like a large state in the lower 48.
that.
Oliver Levitt is a whaling captain and treasurer of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, a position he has held since the corporation started in July 1972. There are less than 4,000 shareholders, most of them in Barrow, the rest in eight villages scattered on the tundra.
There's really no bushes or anything like that. It's a vast amount of land that really has nothing on it except like grazing grounds. It's really nothing there. And barren ground and windswept. But there is game, and we've managed to survive up there over the years.
ASRC is surviving as well. Shareholders have received dividends for the past 3 years, and the corporation is operating in the black. And it's the black gold, oil, that is largely responsible for the financial well-being. Chevron, Mobil, and Union Amoco have leases on nearly all of the corporation's lands, most of them adjacent to the western and southern boundaries of NPRA, National Petroleum Reserve Alaska. NPRA, formerly called PET-4, is a 34,000-square-mile area of the North Slope, created in 1923 by the federal government.
We were precluded from ever selecting land from NPRA, which was the subsurface. We could select the surface for the village corporations, but the subsurface was retained because the petroleum reserve was a reserve for the federal government. And so in all the lands that we had for the villages, we have four villages in PET-4, we had to make what's called in-lieu selections, which was subsurface selections outside of NPRA. But in light of that, after the settlement, the D2 legislation, the Alaska Lands legislation came on, we were able to float an amendment, what was called a severed estate amendment, where we have the right to go back into NPRA once they opened it up for lease sales. And so we do have that amendment. If there is a strike, let's say within 75-mile radius of any village, we have the right to go back in and pick up the subsurface within 40 years, but only under the village lands.
A 1977 survey of North Slope Eskimos, conducted by the Institute of Social and Economic Research of the University of Alaska, showed nearly equal numbers saying that there were good effects due to oil development and that more jobs were available, as those stating that there were bad effects on game and the environment. Levitt estimates that the oil industry has spent $250,000 on exploration. Most of that has involved ASRC subsidiaries, partnerships, and joint ventures, including construction companies, one union, another non-union, technical and engineering services, and a company that owns and operates oil rigs. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated is a partner in that firm. In addition, ASRC owns a media production facility, Barrow Cable TV, a hotel in Barrow, and a school bus system. But most of the investments are oil-related and development-directed.
Well, sure, because Congress in its wisdom said that you corporations shall be profit-motive organizations. And one other things that we do in having these large construction companies is keeping our people working and at the same time looking for the for oil and gas on our own lands. And we are continually looking, and I'm sure that one day that we will find one, it'll be a great benefit to all of the Alaska Natives, not just for Arctic Slope.
It'll be a benefit due to the 7i revenue-sharing provision of ANCSA. Already, by the end of 1979, ASRC distributed $9.5 million to the other in-state regional Native corporations as required, and received, during the same period of time, $171,000 from all the other regions combined. With 95% of their land conveyed, significant deposits of coal, oil, and gas, and an aggressive development posture, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is likely to continue making significant payments under 7i. Treasurer Oliver Levitt.
I would think and would like to believe that Arctic Slope is one of the top ones up there. We have always jumped in probably a lot faster than some of the regions because of our ability to not baffle about whether we should decide or not. We've always been able to have that confidence among each other as directors that if we're going to decide something, we better do it pretty fast or the world's going to go right by us.
When you're born and raised on Alaskan land, when you're born and raised on Alaskan land.
Alaskan land, it's hard to see change come. Some stay and try to fight it, while others turn and run. We've tried both ways, and now we're trying just to understand. You can slow it down, but it's hard to stop the changing of this land.
We're playing high-stakes games, and to move too fast sometimes can be real dangerous.
Dave Williams is Vice President of Lands for Doyon Limited, the regional native corporation for the interior. Doyon is the Athabascan Indian word for chief or leader, and Doyon leads all others in land entitlement. 9 million acres of surface and subsurface rights, most of it from the land lost provision, plus 3.5 million acres of surface estate, making Doyon, once the land is all conveyed, the state's largest private landowner.
It runs from the top of mountains to river bottoms with big trees on it. It's a very fruitful land in a lot of ways. You see the solar basins with all of the game and waterfowl. It's land that's got a lot of promise.
According to Williams, Doyon's approach is careful, not developmental. Tim Wallace is Doyon's president.
Development does not take in all, really, but a small percentage of the land that we're dealing with. None of the activities to date have been within the 25 townships surrounding the villages. Whenever we plan to go into those areas, we will be consulting with the villages and we will plan with extreme care so that we do not disturb any of the traditions or trap lines or existing fish camps or what have you.
This is the Doyon region.
Dave Williams.
Superimposed on the state of Alaska at 1 to 1 million scale. There's about 122 million acres encompassed within the region.
Some of that vast acreage has been explored for development potential, for major minerals.
We ran a big program from 75 through 80 exploring the land, the deficiency lands within the region to see what mineralization was out there and get an idea of what lands we should eventually end up with. And you know, some of that is the asbestos.
The Tanana Asbestos Corporation, a wholly owned subsidiary of Doyon's, has been evaluating the potential of an asbestos deposit 45 miles southwest of the village of Eagle. Analysis indicates the quality is excellent, and Tim Wallace anticipates the mine will be one of the largest in the world. There are other investments as well.
Construction, Arctic Resources, this is moved back in-house.
In 1980, Doyon had a net worth of $54 million and made a net profit of close to $500,000. In 1979, the corporation had more than $1 million in profits. Doyon recently invested $20 million to acquire a 40% interest in an airline and is pursuing the possibility of building or buying an oil refinery in the interior. The corporation invested in a feature film on the life of champion dog musher and Doyon shareholder George Atla, is a stockholder in United Bank Alaska, has two joint venture construction companies, one heavily involved in oil field and pipeline work, owns a hotel on Maui, has percentages in oil lease tracts in the Beaufort Sea, and also has interests in firms involved with land surveying and non-renewable resource reconnaissance. Along with the asbestos near Eagle, one of Doyon Limited's 28 villages, significant amounts of gold and zinc have been found elsewhere, and exploration work continues for other hard rock minerals and oil and gas. Lands Vice President Williams doesn't feel all this exploration will significantly alter the land.
Gee, you know, you have to put your far-seeing goggles on. In my lifetime, a lot of the land will look just like it looks right now. The rigs and the pits will be on an insignificant acreage.
Doyon Limited President Tim Wallace.
To secure the fact that we're going to be able to continue our way of life is we're going to have a lot of encroachments. And in order to have strength, we'll need the economic strength to help combat it.
You have been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, the First 10 Years, the seventh program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to musicians Herbie Vent, Buddy Tabor, Otz and Nedra Kilcher, Sebastian McGinty and George Silas, and the Point Hope Episcopal Church Congregation. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5 from Educational Media Services, Star Route Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska 99701.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The corporate whale, ANCSA, the first 10 years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
More than 200 villages and groups were eligible to receive benefits under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, the nearly $1 billion and 44 million acres given in exchange for extinguishing Aboriginal rights. To manage those benefits, Congress mandated the creation of village corporations, either not-for-profit or profit-making entities. All chose the business option and set up new corporations in addition to existing traditional and political councils. Seven villages chose to remain reservations: Gamble, Savunga, Klukwan, Elam, Arctic Village, and Venati. Unlike village corporations, reserves receive both surface and subsurface entitlements, do not share in the money distribution under ANCSA, and are independent of regional corporations. Village shareholders are also regional corporation shareholders, with 100 shares of stock in each. Many of the people working for a claim settlement wanted to center the benefits on the villages whose people used and occupied the land, and did not wish to create regional corporations as overseers. Emil Noddy, the first president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, was an advocate of that position.
Our original proposal called for 95% of the money to go to the villages, because it was the villages that were losing the land. People living off the land were being impacted the most.
In this program, the eighth in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, village and regional corporation leaders will discuss village-centered approaches to managing ANCSA's land and money entitlement and impact.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing the mock talk between family and friends. We're sailing towards the future, we're anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way will surely last.
With a small population base to draw upon for leadership, village corporations were faced with the task of organizing into business entities and selecting land entitlements within 3 years after ANCSA's passage. Villages were granted the land surface only, with regional corporations receiving the subsurface entitlement, the only instance in which villages were on top of regions, for the village corporations were under their aegis for a number of years. The Act stated that for 5 years, regional corporations were to approve village corporation articles of incorporation and amendments to them, to review and approve annual budgets. And for 10 years after the date of enactment, until December 18, 1981, regional corporations advised village corporations on land actions, though desire for traditional use on the surface could conflict with hoped-for revenues from subsurface resource development. It was a relationship that, while helpful for some fledgling village corporations, impeded the identity of others and promoted the image of regional corporations as the instruments of land claims implementation. The statewide ANCSA Village Corporation, SAVA, is now working to advocate on behalf of village corporations. Rosemary Maher is a charter member of SAVA, serves on the Doyon board, and is president of Northway Natives.
We've been lumped in as Doyon Regional Corporation villages, and we don't have our own identity. But yet we're operating as two separate corporations with essentially two different ideas on which should be, because Doyon is mostly a resource-minded corporation, where the village corporations can't take that attitude because they don't have the resources. They only have the surface rights, which would maybe timber. But other than that, I don't see that they have anything common with what Doyon's goals and objectives are. So there's a definite difference in the organizations.
Differences that are perhaps most acute in Barrow, headquarters for the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. ASRC's treasurer, Oliver Levitt.
I confess that we don't and have not had that closer relationship with our own local village corporation in Barrow, and it's just a mainly difference in philosophy and the type of work that we do.
Dale Stotz, corporate manager for the Etkiahvik Inupiat Corporation, the Barrow Village Corporation.
A formidable corporate strength that is in the region is one of a colonialistic nature. So somewhere along the line in the growth of the regional corporations and their activities, they have disadvantaged the village level of growth, largely because they are more impressed by the other outside interests in the regional domain, that is, development of resource, oil and gas resources.
Without the land subsurface to draw on, village corporations have purchased or started general stores, hardware and building supply stores, built office buildings both in the village and in Anchorage, operated sawmills, initiated cold storage facilities, started construction companies and fuel depots, and in some cases joined with regional corporations in ventures related to the oil industry. A number of villages have merged with each other to maximize their investment potential and minimize administrative costs. And in one region, NANA, the Northwest Alaska Native Association, 10 of the 11 village corporations in the region found it advantageous to merge with the regional corporation. John Schaefer is NANA's president.
We took what we thought was a Western system that wasn't going to work very well, and we made it more Eskimo, where we were closer together and we worked closer together for the same goal. So I don't think if you consider NANA just a business corporation that gobbled up other corporations in order to get more land, I suppose you could look at it that way, but that's not the way we view NANA.
Kotzebue is the largest village in the NANA region and is the only one of the area's village corporations to withhold from the merger. Legislator Al Adams is the president of the Kikitakruk Inupiat Corporation, KIC.
We feel that as a large village corporation that we can manage our assets here and then have control here in Kotzebue. And we can do more good for the people here in Kotzebue than if we did merge. But I'm happy to say that I'm glad to see the other smaller villages have merged with NANA, because I think in the long run it will help be a beneficial financially to the village corporation and its shareholders.
In its first 10 years, KIC has done well for its 2021 shareholders.
We have our annual report, which I'll hand you here for your copy, and that's the 80, and it'll show you some of the investments.
KIC's buildings, construction company, and stock. They're the only village corporation with stock in the all-native corporation-owned United Bank Alaska. Yielded a profit of close to $800,000 for 1981, and Adams predicts $1 million profit for next year. There's a message from the chairman of the board on the inside cover of the 1980 annual report. It says, in part, In the past, as warriors and hunters, we determined our own destiny. Once again, as corporate shareholders and managers, we have become the masters of our future.
Mornings early we head out town. Follow the trails where the hunters go down. Whispering in silence, the sled moves along. Singing a kid.
My name is Glenn Fredericks, and I'm the president of the Kuskokwim Corporation, villages that merged in the Kuskokwim area, upper area, from Kalskag all the way to Stony River. In 1977, I believe it was, that we merged into one, throwing everything in one pot, kind of, you know. And we have our main offices here in Anchorage, and we take care of our own funds. We invest them in different banks in state of Alaska, also in Lower 48.
The 10 villages in the merger own office and apartment buildings in Aniak, built by the corporation. A clinic in Kalskag are conducting gravel and timber studies with hope of developing those resources, and have land holdings and buildings in Anchorage. The Kuskokwim Corporation, which is part of the Chulister region, has a branch office in Aniak, but conducts most of the business from their antique furnished office in downtown Anchorage.
But it's very hard to do business in a little village, you know.
The business conducted in the big city has been profitable.
We haven't, as any other village, haven't valued our land yet. Really, it's very hard to come up with a value of land, say, in Crooked Creek, you know, because there's never been any sales. But our total assets is, with the buildings we own and everything, is about $12 million.
Dividends were distributed for the past 2 years, and net profits last year were around $750,000.
You don't hear too many villages corporations making that kind of a profit.
Tanana, Minana, Stevens Village, Alatna, Alakakit, Hughes, and Hustia.
Those seven villages in the Doyon region in interior Alaska are members of River Villages Incorporated. Walter Carlo of Tanana is the corporation's president and is also a member of the Doyon Limited Board.
You might say we're just joint ventured, as opposed to merged or consolidated into one organization. All the villages still have control over their own lands. And that's was the whole idea behind this organization. Organizations also is not to put everything in the same pot.
The group had its first organizational meeting 7 years ago and decided not to merge, but to retain individual village control over lands and internal affairs. In the Doyon region, there are, however, three merged corporations. Ganayu, meaning friends together in Kayakon Athabascan, a merger of Galena, Kayakuk, Kaltag, and Nulato, and MTNT, the villages of McGrath, Talida, Nikolai, and Takotna, and another merger of the Kayakuk River villages of Alatna, Alakakit, Hughes, and Huslia, all members of River Villages Incorporated as well. To join River Villages requires a minimum $100,000 investment, based on $1,000 per shareholder for a small village corporation of 100 shareholders. The fee does not increase for larger villages, and there is no ceiling on the amount that may be invested in the hopes of getting larger returns.
So far, we've looked at river transportation, construction, communications, and like everybody else, we went into heavy excavating work. We know there'll be a lot of work out in rural areas, and that's the areas we'll be concentrating on. We're looking at services to the villages. They're our number one priority, shareholder hire, and profit. We know that the villages have half of the capital, so if we could pull it together somehow, maybe we could, there's some great things ahead, I think.
You've been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, the First 10 Years, the eighth program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to musicians Herb Event, Buddy Tabor, Ted Wesley, and Will Ackerman. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5 from Educational Media Services, Starroot Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska 99701.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, the First 10 Years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
It is indeed with great pleasure and honor that I have this privilege of calling the 15th Annual Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives, commemorating the 10th anniversary of the passage of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, to order. First, on behalf of the Alaska Federation of Natives, its board of directors, and its president, I would like to take this opportunity of welcoming each and every delegate, each and every attendant, each and every student that's here attending this very commemorative moment.
A blue banner with the state of Alaska in gold hung on the wall behind Alaska Federation of Natives Chairman Nelson Ongapuk as he called the convention to order on December 16, 1981. Three interlocking rings were superimposed on the state, the top one bearing the word Eskimo, the one on the right labeled Indian, and the ring on the left Aleut, signifying the unity of the ethnic groups that comprise Alaska's natives and the membership of the AFN. In 1966, 99 years after the transfer of Alaska from Russia to the United States, the Alaska Federation of Natives first met to plan a unified effort to obtain a settlement for land claimed by Alaska's Aboriginal peoples. Scarcely more than 5 years later, in December 1971, convention delegates voted to accept the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, negotiated by AFN representatives, special interest groups, notably oil companies, and Congress. That bill provided for 12 in-state regional corporations to distribute the terms of the settlement, 44 million acres of land and nearly $1 billion in exchange for relinquishing further claims to the land. But there was no provision for the continuation of the statewide group that had lobbied for and won the bill. This program, the ninth in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, will examine the role of the Alaska Federation of Natives and its efforts to survive and continue to be a unifying body for the corporations who manage ANCSA's benefits.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing the mock talk between family and friends. We're sailing towards the future, we're anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way will surely last.
The thing attributed to
AFN's first president, Emil Noddy.
Bob Bennett was area director for BIA in Alaska. he went back and was sworn in as commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
So in April of 1966, Bob Bennett issued his report to the Senate Interior Committee, telling what he was going to do to solve the Indian problem in America. In that report, he devoted half a page to Alaska and said that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was drawing up a final solution to the land problem in Alaska. I read that report and got to thinking, if the BIA was going to draw up a final solution, then the Indian people ought to have something to say about it.
Noddy, then president of the Cook Inlet Native Association, wrote letters to Native leaders around the state, solicited funds, and organized the first meeting of what became the Alaska Federation of Natives. He expected less than 24 people to attend. 300 showed up. He was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives from April 1966 until October 1970, and he faced the challenge of getting Native groups whose ancestors sometimes traded and often fought to work together.
You know, history isn't that old. I was talking to Willie Hensley one day, and when I was a kid, we trapped up the Kaikuk River, and I said, you know, we were always afraid of those fierce Eskimos of the Kobuk Valley. And he, in turn, said when he was a kid, his parents told him, you know, don't go over to the Kaikuk River drainage because there's fierce Indians over there. So there was some of that, and then there is some of that, but it's disappearing. It was very difficult to pull people together to form a statewide group and work together for a common cause. And, you know, we had some very hot meetings. We were dealing with some tough issues as well as all the regional, I don't want to say animosities, but regional differences.
Early versions of the Land Claims Settlement Bill provided for the continuation of at least one statewide coordinating organization, with the bulk of the entitlement going to villages, not regions as mandated by the act now in effect. Willie Hensley, a former state legislator, now president of the United Bank Alaska and chairman of NANA Development Corporation, joined with Noddy in the early days of congressional negotiations.
I think that the lack of a statewide entity of some sort, I think, maybe was a mistake. But, you know, we never had the luxury of being able to think everything through. You know, many of us were young. We were going at 50 miles an hour all the time, trying to stay on top of things. Many of us didn't have the benefit of wise counsel, you know, from elders. And things were moving too fast. It was like being on top of a wave with a little surfboard, you know, trying to stay on top of it or get engulfed by it.
Lee Gorsuch, now director of the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research, came to Alaska in 1970 as an economic planner with the Ford Foundation.
There was a great deal of fear that somehow a statewide Native corporation could subvert the intentions and will of the individual Native corporations. And there was also a feeling within the state of Alaska that a large Native, statewide Native corporation could serve as a threat and represent a third form of government in Alaska. So the fact that the Native leadership itself had its own misgivings about the notion of a statewide corporation, combined with the opposition of the state, pretty much was a conclusive element that no one in Congress was going to go out on a limb arguing for a statewide corporation if neither the state of Alaska nor the Native leadership wanted one. And there was growing suspicion in the 11th hour of the negotiations that somehow having this funnel at the top could subvert the actual flow of funds down to the 12 corporations. It was a chance that many of the Native regional leaders did not want to take, and therefore eliminated it.
An act that almost eliminated the Alaska Federation of Natives entirely. Without an economic base, the organization that formed to lobby for a land claim settlement went through tough times once the act became law. Willie Hensley became the organization's unpaid president. The AFN was in debt, and for 6 months he was unsalaried. Former Alaska Vista volunteer John Shively, now NANA Development Corporation's vice president for operations, served as the AFN's executive vice president.
The power sort of changed from AFN, that had been sort of the leading spokesman organization for Native people during the Settlement Act, and that power changed to the regional corporations to a certain extent. Village corporations also, but primarily the regions who began to have the money and the leadership. And I think it's quite possible the AFN could have died And what saved AFN was the federal government, and not on purpose, of course, as usual, but the federal government in 1972 and 73 tried to rewrite the Claims Act by regulations and essentially take most of what had been won away. And Native leaders throughout the state began to understand that what they won, although it was a difficult battle, might not be half as hard as keeping what they thought they'd won. And that brought people back together again, and I think it's kept them together.
Not that togetherness has been the theme of the Alaska Federation of Natives, although a dues structure for membership was first approved in December 1973, achieving some financial base for the organization. Not all eligible regional Native corporations have elected to join and work within the structure. Some corporations, such as Arctic Slope and the Aleut Corporation, have been in and out of the AFN. Recent changes in the bylaws now permit both regional profit and nonprofit corporations to join, and by the time of the December 1981 AFN convention, all 12 in-state profit corporations were members. At the convention, AFN Chairman Nelson Ongapa.
For the first time in several years, all of the 12 regional corporations that were formed pursuant to the Land Claim Settlement Act are represented in this convention. The Aleut Corporation has rejoined AFN, and at this point, I would very much like to welcome Aleut in rejoining the group.
Still, one Native corporation is not a member, the ANCSA Optional, Seattle-based 13th Regional Corporation for Alaska Natives living outside the state. They have petitioned for membership and been denied. Janie Leisk is the AFN's executive vice president.
There are a lot of hard feelings between the regional corporations and the 13th region when it came down to re-enrollment, when the enrollment came up again. And the 13th region really had pushed hard to get the shareholders from the regional corporations.
In addition, the in-state regional corporations are land-based, unlike the 13th, now seeking a piece of the land entitlement. It puts that corporation on the outs of an organization that seeks a unified approach to land issues, AFN's primary focus. With a large board of directors representing different ethnic groups and geographic areas of the state, achieving unity requires a good deal of internal politics.
The Tlingits certainly have different ways of running businesses and running their corporations than maybe some of the Eskimos do. And just the personalities and the traits of the people are a lot different.
These differences can lead to splits away from AFN.
We're an organization who represents, if not all of the Alaska Natives, then we represent the majority of them. If AFN ever existed to where there was maybe four or five regional corporations that were out of AFN, then maybe we would have to reassess it. But with maybe one corporation out, which has been the case, then we still feel that we pack a punch back in Washington, speaking with one organization for all the corporations. Right now we have a Washington, D.C. representative, Dennis Tippelman. We felt it was really important due to the federal cutbacks affecting the nonprofit, and in addition to any other kind of information, just to keep on top of legislation, just to keep on top of the different issues.
My job down
AFN
here.
AFN Washington, D.C. representative Dennis
sure
Tippelman.
Check every conceivable document that might have a notice of proposed rule, whether it's in the Federal Register or a notice into the House or Senate side as far as which legislation has been introduced, and then to maintain a list of contacts as far as the players that are involved and what they might be doing over the course of the year. So sometimes my job is to read, research, and other times it's to meet with people and convince them of who the Native corporations are and what it is that they're doing, and try to secure something that is maybe favorable to their viewpoint. And it's helpful for the Native corporations and for the Alaska Federation of Natives, because some of this information they get, but they might get it through the mails a few weeks or several days too late. And by me researching it here constantly on a daily basis, I can get to them and alert them to information that might have relevance to them by just making a phone call.
Tippelman's recent phone calls relate to Congress's current budget-cutting mood, which significantly affects Native American programs.
We've been relatively
comfortable and have found services pretty easy up until the 70s. This is the first time that the 80s look like we're going to have some tough times, and I think it's realistic, not entirely appropriate, but something that can allow us to become better survivors in the 20th century world.
You've been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, The First 10 Years, the 9th program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to Tim Frasca and musicians Herbie Vent, Buddy Tabor, the Kotzebue Northern Lights Dancers. Cassette copies of this program are available from Educational Media Services, SR Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.